Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Hale Corp came in with the S Corp and it quit paying. All this bill does is make them pay.
Lawmakers discuss changing the way oil companies are taxed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska state troopers will soon begin using body-worn cameras.
Increase the transparency that the public has and, you know, continue to bolster the trust that the public has in the Alaska state troopers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Alaska state troopers and other state public safety officials will soon begin wearing body cameras. The State Department of Public Safety released its final body-worn camera policy today. Spokesman Austin McDaniel says 30 officers have already been equipped with cameras.
These troopers and officers can provide us feedback on the policy, the technology, some of the logistics concerns, to make sure that we have everything in place before we go and issue out cameras to every state trooper, every wildlife trooper, every court services officer, deputy fire marshal, and village public safety officer that's working throughout the state.
McDaniel says the initial camera rollout is happening in interior and south central Alaska down to the Kenai Peninsula, as well as in southeast and in Kodiak. He says the department aims to get all troopers equipped by the end of the year. A draft of the policy was released in February for public comment. McDaniel says the 9-page final policy did not change much, and there is still a requirement that troopers keep the cameras on at all times while dealing with the public, except during specific circumstances.
You know, troopers will still be expected to, you know, activate their body-worn camera once they're issued one in the same manner that they activate their dash camera system today or a personal audio recorder.
The policy allows for the public to get access to camera footage through a records request. The Public Safety Department can also preemptively release footage of critical incidents like trooper shootings before investigations have completed. McDaniel says the state hopes the cameras will help complement existing police work and build community trust.
We do believe these are going to enhance our investigations. These are going to keep our officers safe. These are going to really help us with better prosecutions and increase the transparency that the public has and, you know, continue to bolster the trust that the public has in the Alaska State Troopers.
The cameras are being paid for using about $3.6 million from the state and another roughly $1 million in federal grants. Meanwhile, there is still no timeline for when the Anchorage Police Department, the state's largest law enforcement agency, will outfit its officers with body-worn cameras more than 2 years after voters approved them. Last month, the city's chief of police announced the department would go forward with implementing the cameras while negotiations with the police officers' union continue. Experts clashed over a proposed bill that would increase the amount oil and gas companies pay to the state of Alaska at a Senate committee meeting today. Among other provisions, the bill would make privately held corporations pay the same amount as publicly traded companies. Robin Brenna is an attorney who has spent decades working on oil and gas issues. He testified on the bill today, saying that closing the loophole is important after privately held Hilcorp took over BP's Alaska assets in 2020.
There was a huge gap because BP paid corporate income taxes for producing on its third interest at Prudhoe Bay, and Hilcorp came in with the S Corp and it quit paying. All this bill does is make them pay.
The Department of Revenue estimates the bill could give Alaska another $1 billion per year, enough to close the current budget shortfall. Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski introduced the legislation in March. It would also reduce the oil tax credit the state pays per barrel of oil produced from $8 to $5. and it would change the way oil companies get credit for investing in new fields, which Wilikowski says would incentivize more investment within Alaska. But Rich Ruzero, the CEO of N3 Energy, said that more taxes could stifle development as oil companies face steep headwinds from environmental groups. He said Alaska already faces challenges attracting new investors, and raising taxes now is a bad idea.
When we talk about the green environment that's upcoming, it rewards for companies being quick, being fast, getting my money in and out, and doing it multiple times, as opposed to a place like Alaska where things have extremely long lead times, extremely high unit costs.
Testimony on the bill will continue through the end of the week. The public can testify on the bill Thursday. The Sullivan Arena in Anchorage is no longer Alaska's biggest homeless shelter. Capacity was slashed today, down to a quarter of what it had been for much of the winter. But the exodus was not sudden. Many had already left in the last week, and only a trickle of people walked out today. Some people got last-minute housing placements, some caught flights out of town to stay with friends or relatives, and many others left looking for a place to camp. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
On Monday morning, David Marsit was on the main floor of the Sullivan Arena, looking frazzled. He was packing up his belongings in a pair of heavy-duty plastic totes as shelter workers disassembled cots around him.
I'm feeling pretty chaotic right now, to say the least.
He had a work shift beginning soon. He wasn't sure how to keep his stuff safe or where he'd be sleeping at the end of the day.
And I don't want to lose my job. I'm trying to keep it. So I'm doing the best I can to try to make this work. But, you know, getting re-evicted is not helping matters. So that's where I'm at.
Marsit was one of 166 people who stayed at the Sullivan on the last night before an assembly policy took effect, limiting capacity to only the 90 most vulnerable people. Elected officials and the Sullivan's neighbors hope this marks the beginning of the end of the arena, serving as the city's de facto mass homeless shelter of last resort since the COVID-19 pandemic first reached Alaska more than 3 years ago. Marsit had been at the Sullivan for about a week, and he was not sentimental about its doors closing on him.
It's been a place to sleep. That's it.
Still, he wishes he had a little more time to get back on his feet without having to scramble. There just isn't enough alternative shelter space or affordable housing for everyone in Anchorage, which means a lot of people will have to make do outdoors, camping in public spaces. It was an uneventful transition on Monday. Alexis Johnson, the municipality's homelessness coordinator, contrast it with the abrupt closure last summer.
Last year, we shut the doors, we locked them up, and we said, hey, we have transportation, it's going to Centennial, but if you're not on that bus, you just can't stay here. And so this year, because we kind of have this drop down, it's offered us a little bit more of a graceful transition for people to slowly roll out.
Tables of donated clothes and odds and ends were among the last stops for clients leaving the Sullivan on Monday morning.
And we're just letting all the clients pick through them and see if there's any warm gear, any outdoor stuff that they want or need before they go hit the streets, unfortunately.
By lunchtime, Marsit was outside the Sullivan, wolfing down a slice of pizza. His employer was flexible about letting him start later than usual, and he worked out storage for his stuff for another 24 hours. He still didn't know where he'd be sleeping at the end of the day. Maybe a hostel, he thought. He hopped on his bike and pedaled off to his work shift. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage middle school student finds joy in making music with his family.
She accompanies me when I play the violin, so I think that's like a really just in general like fun. It was like really joyful being able to play instruments with my parents.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Sexual violence affects nearly every household in America. If someone you love has experienced sexual assault or abuse, it can be a lot to handle. Reach out to the National Sexual Assault Hotline today to learn how to support someone you care about. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Army officials have identified the three soldiers who died Thursday after the two helicopters they were flying collided in midair near Healy. The victims are 39-year-old Chief Warrant Officer 3 Christopher Aramo of Oneonta, New York, 28-year-old Chief Warrant Officer 2 Kyle McKenna of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and 32-year-old Chief Warrant Officer Stuart Wayment of North Logan, Utah. A fourth soldier who was injured in the crash and transported to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital is still undergoing treatment there. A news release issued Saturday by the 11th Airborne Division says the service member was in stable condition. Army officials have not yet released the soldier's name. 11th Airborne spokesperson John Pinnell said the soldiers were flying two AH-64 Apache helicopters with the Fort Wainwright-based 1st Attack Battalion 25th Aviation Regiment. He said the Apaches were returning Thursday afternoon from a training mission in the Donnelly Training Area near Fort Greely when they collided and crashed about 50 miles east of Healy. Pinnell said Friday that the helicopter crews sent to rescue the soldiers had to use hoists to get into the crash site. He said that there wasn't much information available yet about weather or other factors that may have contributed to the collision. But he said investigators were scheduled to fly in Saturday to the crash site. The Federal Aviation Administration has restricted air traffic within 25 nautical miles of the crash site through May 4th to facilitate the investigation. Thursday's crash is the second this year involving 11th Airborne Apache helicopters in Alaska. In February, two soldiers with the 11th Airborne Battalion were injured when the Apache they were in crashed soon after takeoff from the Talkeetna Airport, where they'd stopped to refuel on their way back from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. In March, nine soldiers were killed in Kentucky when the Black Hawk helicopter they were in crashed during a routine nighttime training exercise. In response to the crashes, the Army on Friday grounded all its aviation units and ordered them to conduct training this week before they'd be allowed to fly again. It took four tries, but a Pacific Dataport satellite, especially designed to overcome Alaska's communication challenges, blasted off from a SpaceX launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, last night.
3, 2, 1, engines full power, and liftoff of Viasat 3. Go Viasat, go Falcon Heavy.
On Wednesday, the flight was delayed by technical issues. Then came torrential rains and a lightning strike to the rocket on Thursday. On Friday, another technical problem shut down the flight just a minute before takeoff, but on Sunday, a rocket called Falcon Heavy successfully carried the satellite into space. Brian Murkowski, a spokesperson for Pacific Dataport, says the Aurora 4A will be a game changer.
Remote communities will have effectively the same capabilities and services that you would get in Seattle or San Francisco or LA. And furthermore, it won't cost you an arm and a leg. It will be competitive.
Pacific Dataport says Alaska has been served by satellites designed primarily to serve the lower 48, but Aurora 4A is positioned higher above the Earth and looks down directly on Alaska, which gives it the capability to serve areas where satellite service has been unavailable or cost prohibitive. The company says it's not as fast as fiber optic cable, but it does allow heavy users to switch between other satellite providers that provide faster speeds for high-priority data download while saving money when using Aurora 4A's backhaul capabilities. Pacific Dataport says Aurora 4A is the first of its kind, a micro-geostationary satellite, which orbits in lockstep with Alaska. It's smaller in size, but with advanced technology that gives it more data capacity. Northern Lights ABC 8th grader Han Kum was an accomplished pianist at his church, but he almost gave up on music before he discovered his love for violin as part of his school orchestra class. After winning a chamber music competition last summer, Han is now thinking about his future in music. Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky has the story.
Han Kum sits at a black upright piano and carefully places his fingers on the keys. He wears all black clothing, as he would while performing in concert, and begins playing Frédéric Chopin's Nocturne No. 9 inside a classroom. Han and his family came to Alaska from South Korea in 2014. His father, Juan, is the pastor of a church where Han plays piano alongside his mother, and his oldest brother plays the drums. With instruction from his mother and encouragement from his father, Han Kum has become one of the most talented young musicians in Anchorage.
My mom's the one who taught me piano, and sometimes I play the violin, my mom plays the piano, she accompanies me when I play the violin, so I think that's like a really just, in general, like fun. It was like really joyful being able to play instruments with my parents.
In sixth grade, Han wanted to join the orchestra class, but that meant choosing a new instrument, one with strings. A member of his church gave him a violin, and he began learning to play, mostly by himself. Northern Lights ABC School Orchestra teacher Katie Eakes saw Hans' talent early on, but couldn't hear him play in person due to the COVID-19 pandemic. With no orchestra to rehearse with, Han bowed the strings of the violin for Eakes over a Zoom call.
He's gone from being a beginner to being top of the line for his age and his age group, and compared to his peers, he's really kind of shooting for the stars.
Han says he almost gave up on music. In fifth grade, he attempted to learn his father's favorite song on the piano, Chopin's Revolutionary Etude, but was unable to master the complicated piece of music. He stopped playing piano briefly, but says his teacher, Miss Eakes, helped him rediscover why he played in the first place.
Since I was younger, piano was sometimes a bit stressful for me, since I had to like put it in with like studies and everything in general. But then, so around sixth grade, I kind of like moved away from the piano a little bit. And then I started violin, and I think Miss Eakes really taught me how like fun it was to just be like involved in music in general. So just overall, just like Miss Eakes has taught me how to like have fun with music. So I think that's what brought me back into piano as well.
In 2022, Han attended the Anchorage Chamber Music Festival Summer Intensive, an 8-day event for musicians from middle school to their mid-20s. Han only planned to play his violin, but he surprised his peers and competition judges when he signed up on piano for the student competition. Zachary Spontak is the education director for the Anchorage Chamber Music Festival. He helped judge the competition Han entered last summer. Taking a bit of revenge on the Chopin piece that had eluded him, Spontak says Han nailed the Revolutionary Etude during the competition.
And he comes out and plays this amazingly virtuosic, fast, very difficult piece of music, and we just didn't see it coming, you know? So it was pretty cool, you know? We didn't know what to expect, and we were just kind of blown away. So it was awesome.
He won. Spontak says that not only was Han the youngest musician entered in the competition, he was the only one who played two instruments during the summer intensive.
He really puts in the work, you know, and I really respect that. So he gets it done. And of course, he has some nice help from his mother and with both his parents. And but he really motivates himself, too. So I think that's, you know, he's on the right path.
Han will perform for the last time with the Northern Lights ABC School Orchestra May 10th and has already auditioned for advanced orchestra at Service High School, which he will attend next fall.
In general, I think like my like goals with music is just to be able to be good enough to make other people like happy or just like feel emotions while listening to me play.
Han says he hopes to share his music with others and to one day teach young musicians, just as his mother and Miss Eakes taught him. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com. In rural Alaska communities, Village Public Safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
The Federal Subsistence Board is considering whether to dramatically curtail hunting to protect an embattled Western Arctic caribou herd. Right now, hunters can harvest up to 5 caribou per day on federal lands. A proposed emergency order before the Federal Subsistence Board would cut that limit to 4 Western Arctic caribou per year. Federal officials say the proposal is spurred by concern for the health of the Western Arctic herd. Biologist Tom Plank says the herd has shrunk by more than half since its peak in 2003.
The Western Arctic caribou herd has continued to decline, and with the most recent estimate being at 164,000 caribou. The proponents are greatly concerned about the precipitous decline and feel that immediate action is needed to slow the decline and prevent the herd from reaching a point of no return.
The Western Arctic caribou herd is one of the largest in the world, and until recently was the largest herd in Alaska. According to an advisory group, its migration stretches across an area roughly the size of California. The herd spends the summer calving months on the North Slope and moves as far south as the Seward Peninsula in the winter. The Northwest Arctic Regional Advisory Council proposed the emergency measure. At the hearing, a large majority of those who spoke were critical of the proposed 4-caribou annual limit. Some, like Kotzebue resident and lifelong hunter Roswell Colley-Yoke Schaefer, said the board should focus on caribou hunters from outside the region.
My recommendation is we stop all aerial hunting in the North Slope in our region, period. For the native folks, we're going to have to tighten our belts. We have to not hunt as much as we used to for a while until we can get the caribou back again.
Several commenters said the 4-caribou limit was unreasonable for hunters caring for a large extended family or for other villages. Kotzebue resident Walter Sampson, who gave his initial comments in Inupiaq, was critical of the meeting itself, citing the lack of an interpreter.
We're speaking in English and denying those folks that speak Inupiaq that who do trapping and hunting. But yet we say we went through the process to go through to get those regulations in place.
The Federal Subsistence Board will hold its next public hearing on the caribou limit on Tuesday and plans to reach a decision about the regulations on June 8th. A trio of male wolverine kits are this year's first animal births at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage. The brothers, who are still unnamed, were born in February to parents Jumbo and Olga. The zoo just recently announced their arrival, giving them time to settle in. The zoo's director, Pat Lampe, says the tiny wolverines are starting to develop personalities.
One of the keepers had a great video, and the baby kind of came right up to the fence and was growling and snarling and acting like he was a real tough guy.
Zookeeper Talea Goodwin says wolverines share a playful demeanor with relatives like minks and ferrets. This is the second litter for parents Jumbo and Olga. Lampe says the birth is also a victory for the zoo's husbandry staff.
Not every place has success, and we tried for several years without any success, but then it finally happened. Nature finds a way.
Wolverines reside in the wild throughout Alaska, but the kits at the zoo likely won't stay here for too long. Lampe expects they'll be transferred to other zoos in need of wolverines. Their parents came to Alaska from zoos in Sweden and Russia. The best chance for visitors to see the kits in the wolverine exhibit is in the morning hours. Well, the final stitches were pulled on an Anunga open-skin boat in April. As KUCB's Kenesha McGlashan Price reports, this vessel will be the first of its kind to touch water in over two centuries.
That's it.
There you go, and then back around. Back around, there you go.
Dozens of people gathered to help tie lashings on an Anunga open-skin boat, nearly 30 feet long. Mark and Leah Daniels are the owners of Mind's Eye Manufactory and the founders of Make Access IKEA Apprenticeships. Mark Daniels is not Anunga himself, but has helped facilitate IKEAN, or Anunga Sea Kayak, builds across Anunga territory for the last three decades. During the six-week community build out of his California-based workshop, Daniels is facilitating the construction of a Nigala, an Anunga open skin boat. This will be the third Nigala that has been built in the last year, but the first to touch water in over two centuries.
There is a great significance to this vessel in my mind, because the removal of it 200 and something years ago was done intentionally to control the Anunga people.
Like the IKEA, the Nigala frame is a collection of artfully shaped wood pieces lashed together with synthetic sinew or twine. Kawa skins, or sea lion, would traditionally cover these frames, but heavy nylon fabric is what is used today. The history of the Nigala, in comparison to the IKEA, is not as well known. More than two centuries ago, Russian fur traders migrated across Unangam Tanangan, or the Aleutian Chain, inciting a wave of destruction among the indigenous communities they encountered. They enslaved skilled Anunga hunters for the sea otter harvest and destroyed nearly every Nigala to keep the villages from fleeing. These vessels had the ability to carry over 20 people, which Daniel says was a form of empowerment for Anunga.
They could get away they could move, they could pile into one of these and disappear around the next headland or move to the next island and get away. And so the Russian invaders destroyed the vessels.
The Russians forcefully evacuated Unanga and other Alaska natives to California, where they built the fur traders' southernmost outpost. This post was located at Matini, the ancestral homelands of the Kashaya Pomo, also known today as Fort Ross. The Unanga hunters were never brought back to Unangamtanungan, as they had initially been promised. For the last decade, there have been gatherings to honor the Alaska Native people that were brought to Matini and never returned to their homelands. Lauren Peters is an Unanga PhD student at the University of California, Davis, and is the lead organizer for this event. She is also a descendant of a family that was enslaved at Matini.
Stephen Anesia was her name, and their son Ivan were taken down to Fort Ross, Matini, to be the blacksmiths there. And he was the only blacksmith in all of California. So
Peters says the Titovs, her six great-grandparents, were forcefully brought from Kodiak to Matini. She grew up hearing stories from her mother about what life looked like for the Alaska Native people at Matini, but when she visited in 2013, the fort had little to show about their history. The first Alaska Native Day at Fort Ross was hosted by Fort Ross Conservancy in 2014.
And we're sitting in the back of the room listening to all these non-Unanga talk about us and saying, no, that's wrong. And so I decided right there that if we had another one of these, it would only be us talking about us.
Since then, this event has been organized and hosted by Alaska Native people to celebrate and honor their existence, past, present, and future. During the 2023 Alaska Native Day, the Nigala will be launched at Matini, the first vessel of its kind to touch water in over two centuries. Peter says that they have been welcomed by the Kashaya Pomo to their lands to commemorate this historic event.
It just sort of hit us that we should make the first blessing and launch at Matini. And so that's where that's going to happen, and should be a notable celebration.
Daniel says this Nigala will be for Unanga to participate in gatherings such as tribal journeys in the Salish Sea, Juno celebration, as well as events like Alaska Native Day at Matini. Reporting from Bellingham, Washington, my name is Kenesha McGlashan-Price.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Lex Trinan, Jeremy Shea, Rhonda McBride, and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, and Kenesha McGlashan-Price in Bellingham, Washington. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Emmert, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on. On Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.